I don't think anybody wants to create waste. I don't think anyone feels good about wasting anything, especially people who put so much time, effort, love into a craft. To throw something in the bin seems very ineffective to what you're trying to create.
Hey there, everybody. Danny Vallant back with you for another episode of Dirty Linen. Thank you so much for joining me. I really do not take for granted that you have me in your ears from time to time. Just a reminder that we are doing a fortnightly newsletter. It is great. You'll find little snippets, essays, competitions there that you will not find anywhere else. You can sign up for the newsletter via the Instagram of any of the podcasts across the Deep in the Weeds network, or head to deepintheweeds.com.au and sign up there. We would love to be writing to you and dropping into your inbox as well as into your ears. Today, we are talking to a chef called Chris Locke. Chris is a chef who has a really deep philosophy underpinning the way that he works with food. And one of his focuses at the moment is food waste and working sustainably. He is the chef at the Moving Feast Kitchen, which has recently been set up at the Queen Victoria Market in Melbourne. And he is part of a Chef's Manifesto Action Hub event that is happening in Melbourne later in May. So, Chris, tell us what we would see you getting up to if we came down to the Moving Feast Kitchen.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. We've been open for about 7 weeks now. In that time, we've salvaged 850 kilos of produce from the market vendors that was either overripe, unsellable, or blemished in some way, slightly damaged. About 97% of that was salvageable and edible. And we are producing products. So we're going to be producing products that can be sold at a pantry and cafe that's going to be opening on Peel Street, just within the market, but on Peel Street in a couple of weeks. And hopefully to sell to other retailers around the city.
That is amazing. I mean, it's staggering that there is so much waste, but it's amazing that it's usable and that you're, yeah, I suppose, creating what you're creating, but also demonstrating to others that it's possible. It's sort of alarming and exciting all at once. Give us a sense of, you know, what is this produce? What do people think isn't usable but actually is?
Yeah, there's quite a range in terms of quantity and also type. And for the guys that work in the market and their vendors, they really only have two options, and it's to sell the produce or for it to go into the green bin. There's not really an in-between there. So if customers start to deem something as unattractive, then even at a discount, if they can't sell it, then it goes into the green bin. So we're kind of just coming in as the intermediary, like an extra step in between it being unsellable and compost, essentially, and stepping in there in the middle. But it's a real range, and it can be a case of grapes that have just started to look a little bit sad, but there's nothing wrong with them. Lots of bananas that are overripe. And in one case, we actually got 300 kilos of sweet potatoes that I deemed them to be very usable, but they were unsellable for like guests. Customers did not want to buy them. So we had 300 kilos of sweet potato on our hands, and we had to figure out all the myriad ways that we could use sweet potato.
Wow. I mean, what was wrong with it? You know, what did people think was wrong with it, and what did you do with it?
Aesthetically, there was like blemishing on the skin, but totally edible and in no way unpalatable. Just visually, it kind of looked a little bit unattractive, but that's great for me and great for the cooking processes that we did. What did we do with sweet potato? We have a sweet potato shoyu that's currently fermenting. That's about 40 liters we're going to get out of that. We have sweet potato miso going on. We have a sweet potato brownies We have an XO sauce that we've made from sweet potato, which is actually going to be our first retail product that we're going to be launching in about 2 weeks. So that's essentially subbing the seafood that you would find in the Chinese XO sauce and using roasted sweet potato, adding some culture for it to ferment and create a little bit of umami. And yeah, Bobby's your uncle.
I mean, I'm such a fan of sweet potato, so everything that you said then sounds extremely appealing to me. I mean, what would do you feel like you're are you solving a problem, or are you a sort of stopgap because people don't realize that they could just take this produce home and use it themselves?
Yeah, it does sometimes feel a little futile because the problem still exists, and I really wish this role did not exist and the need for this kitchen did not exist, and that there was no food waste to salvage. That would be the ideal scenario. But the fact is that the system that is set up for, you know, buying and selling vegetables, produce, there's no middle process between something being unsellable but still fine and deemed as waste or deemed as compost, and that's really the challenge. Yeah,
it's highlighting a problem. I mean, I don't know how to think about it. I suppose that every step along the supply chain there are problems with the way that produce is perceived and then either used or not used, and you're grabbing it, you know, right at this end stage. I suppose so much produce doesn't even leave the farm. So, Chris, how does the process work? Is there a place where vendors bring their produce, or do you go around scouting out stuff? What's the process?
It's very much relationship-based. There isn't, apart from picking things out of bins, there isn't really like a receptacle where unsellable produce is put. So it was really a process of talking to the vendors, explaining what we're doing, why we're doing it, and that we're not there to kind of make money from their unsold products, you know, being a social enterprise, and the work that Street does as well as part of the project, that it's really going to a good cause and it's going to make delicious things that can then do good work. So it's really relationship based, and I'm only working with really two vendors, just because it's me, myself, and I in the kitchen, and I can only really handle so much produce. So I've been doing about 120 kilos a week, but that's really just from two suppliers.
And you better explain to us what Street is.
Yes, Street is a social enterprise that provides education and work programs for youth, and does really great work in the community. But they're kind of leading the charge along with Good Cycles on the Moving Feast project, which is what the kitchen is, the project that the kitchen comes under.
I love that. I love both those organizations. During lockdowns, one of the little projects that I had going was getting bikes donated and given to people on temporary visas. And yeah, shout out to Good Cycles for the amazing work that they did in fixing up some bikes and getting them to people who, yeah, just wanted a way to get around that crazy old town in that crazy old period. I love the work that they do, and it's amazing. Amazing that you're part of it in this very different way, but it's such a sense of purpose in a system that I suppose seems pretty broken that you need to do it, but it's great that you are. I don't know. I just have so many mixed feelings about it, but I think that, you know, that probably takes me to our next topic, which I feel is, you know, your feelings about, you know, food systems, the supply chain, and how you come to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah, as my story is mainly restaurant focused. A lot of the work that I've done over the years has been in restaurants. The last 9 years, I was in Canada working at one restaurant for a 6-year block, And that was really where I got to dig deeper into food systems, into how we treat food, how we treat farmers, how we can, you know, make a better impact as chefs and as people who work in the food system, and make a bigger impact on the food system other than just creating food. And it was that process that really brought me to here, and moving from restaurants and into a very, very different sector is a dynamic shift or a paradigm shift, I guess, that I'm no longer responsible for essentially cooking food for people. And like the pinnacle goal is for guests to enjoy their experience, which I think is an issue with restaurants, that guest experience is put before anything else, even our health and well-being and the well-being of farmers and the health of the planet and food system. But I get to be here and just concentrate on the good things, or the things that make positive impact on the food system and in our community.
Wow, that's a real that's a pretty provocative thing to say, or I suppose to posit about restaurants, that this sort of ultimate aim, you know, that so many hospitality people would pride themselves on, that idea of the, you know, this ultimate guest experience, is actually problematic. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yes. I didn't know this was turning into a therapy session, but we'll go that way. Yeah, having worked in restaurants for a long time and been, you know, deeply immersed in that culture, and when all of your friends and colleagues and everyone you speak to is also in the industry, you get to see the toll that it takes on people, the mental toll, physical toll. And that's kind of all done. I mean, there's a number of pathways that people take to get to that position where you're in a restaurant and maybe not indoctrinated, is maybe not the right word, but led to believe that everything should be sacrificed for the plate, the dish, the guest experience, the restaurant. I've seen many, many examples of people really giving everything that they have to a job, to a career, and seeing the breakdown of people from giving way, way too much into something that matters to the guest, and matters to guest experience and accolades and recognition. But in the end, it doesn't really benefit you as a human.
And what was your pathway to this realization?
I don't really know where it started. But I think I got to a point where I was an angry chef. Nowhere near where some people are, but just I didn't enjoy the way that I acted, and the way that I spoke to people, and figured that there could be a better way. The pandemic was a big shift, or a big push to change and to change things, change lifestyle, change philosophy, change approach to work. And that was really a big push into creating a better system. I mean, you're very lucky that you don't have like a entrenched system here in Australia, but whereas working in Canada is very similar to the US in that it's tip driven as well, which has another layer of challenges to working in a restaurant, and another layer of toxicity to working in restaurants as well. So really trying to imagine that there is a better way, and imagine that there's a new pathway to working in restaurants as a viable career, a viable career path that you can do for decades and not come out the other side with PTSD or some kind of physical ailment.
So you spoke about, just like toxic work culture and the enormous pressures that people are under. But then you also mentioned farmers. And I'm just wondering if you could draw together those, you know, the idea, you know, this idea of restaurants and the jobs that they think they need to do, but then you've come out of it as a thinking about sustainability. Like, how did you link these things together?
It's hard to dissect how those connections were made. The restaurant that I was working in was a farm-to table restaurant. So we had relationships and nurtured new relationships with farmers and got to know them personally and also their businesses and their growing seasons and operations quite intricately. And then when you realize the struggles that farmers have, not to mention like the environmental and climate related struggles, but just the struggles in growing and selling and making a farm a profitable operation, which needs to happen in order for them to be a farm. And then linking that with the struggles that restaurants have and in terms of procurement and all of the middlemen that take a piece of the slice when you think about produce buy-in. There's some real power that can be developed from those relationships, and that the people who grow the food and cook the food and deliver the food, that whole supply chain can be shortened and we can actually work in a way that benefits all of the parties without really being extractive in those methods, without extracting human resources, or without being extractive on the land, and yeah, build a system that can be beneficial to everybody and also give a good guest experience at the end while not taking it out of ourselves and the other people who work in the system.
Wow, yeah, that's... Yeah, that sounds like a really good way to go, and perhaps brings us to talk about the UN Sustainable Development Goals and how they relate to this world of food and restaurants and chefs. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I assume everyone is somewhat familiar with the UN Sustainable Development Goals and their very, very high level goals that we need to achieve to keep the planet alive and to have a sustainable world. But they're very kind of like esoteric and removed from a lot of the worlds that cooks and chefs and people in food systems or work directly in food systems work with every day. So the Chef's Manifesto was developed from those sustainable development goals in a way that chefs can easily connect with the goals without having to go high level into all of the things that are really not related to what they're doing. So it's a set of eight thematic areas created by chefs about 8 years ago to guide people in their work to make better decisions and to be empowered and supported to deliver sustainable food systems. There's about 1,300 chefs that are involved in the community with very strong hubs around the world. I think Kenya, India, UK, Italy, Ireland, and a few others have very strong advocacy hubs and action hubs and meetups where like-minded chefs who are people in the food system who are signed up with the Chef's Manifesto, they'll meet and they'll exchange ideas and they'll essentially connecting those dots of people who are already doing some of the work in their own silos, in their restaurant, in their food company, at their farm. And we can connect the dots and build like a bigger community and build strength in what people are doing on an individual level and build a better future together.
Wow. It's so well said. And I guess, you know, we probably shouldn't assume that everybody knows what the UN Sustainable Development Goals are, but it just in a nutshell, there are 17 streams of action that the UN has identified that people can tap into in all kinds of different ways. And they are things like no poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, and so it goes on. And I think you're right, Christian, that they're big ideas, and it's hard to know how to tackle any of these issues in one's own field. But I think what's great about the Chef's Manifesto is that it's very much about starting where you are in your own kitchen, in your own menu writing, in your own way of dealing with food waste. And it's all about taking small steps that will in the end have a large impact. Do you think I'm explaining it properly?
Yes, absolutely.
I think a lot of chefs do feel quite isolated in their own kitchens, and there'd be no one who wouldn't want to make a difference, who wouldn't want to do things better. We all know that it matters to do things better for the planet that we all share, after all. What are some of the things that you've identified that people could start to do?
I think it's really on a case-by-case basis, and what works for one restaurant doesn't work for another, which is one of the challenges in that restaurants operate as their own island nations, and they have very different operations and that need different solutions, which is always the challenge with the restaurant industry. It's so segmented. I really, though, enjoy as more of like a blanket philosophy in the way that we approach waste and ingredients and flavor. And this was kind of a mind shift for myself several years ago, and that we often are pre-programmed to look at certain ingredients as waste, regardless of what recipe we're using it for. You might look at people only use the whites of leeks or up to a certain point, whereas the whole leek is edible. The whole leek has flavor, and the whole leek is an ingredient. And if we stop looking at things as waste and we start looking at things as flavor, then we can really change how we're creating menus, how we're building place of food, and how we're developing flavor through dishes, and not by using our waste to make food, but using whole ingredients to make food. And I think that's an important kind of mind shift. Mm. So a lot of like what I'm doing, for example, at the kitchen, I'd say everything that I get isn't waste. Or 97% of things that I receive from the market, I would not deem as waste. And that 3%, if it was in a little bit of a better shape, also would not be waste. So it's kind of like a perspective shift and how we view ingredients and what is possible. And I think that also comes with education and where our like culinary education system is, where we're still being taught very archaic French techniques in a world that is very vastly different to the world when those techniques were developed. So this is kind of where Chef's Manifesto comes in, and a further education for chefs and people in the industry to be able to further their education in a non-formal way to benefit themselves, their restaurants, the community, the planet, and kind of bring everything back full circle.
What kinds of things do you mean with education? I mean, are you thinking like we don't need to learn how to make reduce a jus, we need to learn how to ferment? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of processes and kind of like wasteful processes that could be adapted. Say garlic skins and onion skins would generally be discarded, or you would be taught to peel ingredients, which a lot of the time isn't necessary. And creating a lot of discard that way. A lot of a lot of unnecessary processes that create waste when it could just be creating flavor even in that dish or outside of that dish in another way.
Yeah, I mean, I think chefs are such amazing problem solvers that once you have these mind shifts, I feel like the creativity must just be exponential. It must actually be really exciting.
Yeah, it really is. Having time to do it is, I think, the biggest challenge for chefs who are so time poor and always stretched. But once you start building that into your processes as a way that you can create ingredients for a menu in 6 months, for example, then it actually will cut down the amount of work that you have to do to create flavor in 6 months when you're creating a menu. At the restaurant in Toronto, we had, obviously, like everywhere that has a bar will usually have a lot of citrus waste after the lemons, oranges, limes have been juiced and zested. The pith will be discarded and is not very edible in its current state, but we ground it and made it into miso. So we had huge amounts of citrus miso that would ferment for somewhere between 3 to 6 months. And then we suddenly had a constant supply of an ingredient that was unique. It was packed with umami. Honestly, we almost used too much of it on the menu because it was so versatile and delicious. It meant that we could easily make dishes with 2 or 3 ingredients because we spent time to do that waste reduction process 3 months ago, which actually made our lives easier further down the line.
That's so interesting. I mean, humans are not excellent at long-term thinking. If we were, we wouldn't be having such a hard time turning the climate ship around. And, you know, chefs are particularly living urgent lives where it's, you know, it's about the next service and it's possibly difficult to think 6 months ahead. One of the other things that, you know, people often say to me when we're talking about sustainable practices is, well, I'd love to do that, but it's more expensive to buy that chicken, or I'd love to do that, but I don't have time to peel and chop my own onions. I mean, what are some of the paradigm shifts that you would encourage people to experiment with to think differently?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. And when we talk about a sustainable diet, it does include buying ingredients from good sources. It means buying organic chicken, like you said, organic vegetables. But it also means eating less meat. It means eating fewer animal products, which, yeah, does reduce your grocery bill. And also stretching your ingredients a little bit more. So it is possible to have chicken with every meal, but it's a small amount of chicken used in a way that you're not eating like a whole chicken breast or the classic Melbourne Palmer as your huge meal for the day. But stretching ingredients so that you can still enjoy food, you can still have a non-vegan diet or a non-vegetarian diet, but that whole chicken will last 2 people for 7 meals instead of 2 people for 3 or 4 meals. Really looking at there's ways that you can do this. If you go down like carbon footprint of your food, it's very easy to see in a simple graph how large a carbon footprint is of beef and lamb and dairy products. So if we're talking about a sustainable diet and we're like carbon is part of that conversation, it's not the be all and end all of the conversation. It's important that we don't get carbon tunnel vision. But I think if you look at a carbon balanced diet, then you can still buy organic chicken and organic eggs and organic cheese, but you're going to be buying a lot less of them. So that balance in reducing the amount of the more expensive things that you're buying and increasing the amount of the cheaper things, the vegetables that you put on your plate, supplementing that with beans as a sustainable protein. I think it's really easy to kind of like shift that scale balance to be in line and bring down your budget even, or balance the budget by eating fewer meat items and more of the cheaper produce items. I do like to talk about food waste, and I talk about using your scraps and reduce the amount of things that you throw away, because there's a huge amount of household waste. But the fact is, a lot of people don't have the time. A lot of people don't have the time to do most of the processes that, I mean, I honestly don't have much time to do the processes that I'm doing in the kitchen here at home. I think that the easiest way is just being mindful of your shopping. Only buy what you need. Don't buy the just in cases. Do some meal planning for 10 minutes before you do a shop and think about what you're going to eat. Think about if you're going to go out for dinner at any point in the week. And I think that's kind of the best way of reducing cost and reducing waste and being able to like balance that sustainable diet conundrum.
Yeah, it's, I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking about that citrus miso and the pleasure that your guests must have had from eating those like flavor bomb meals that you're creating for them, and how nice it must have felt as a chef to know that you were giving them this incredible experience, but it was partly a product of this ingredient that would otherwise have been thought of as waste. I mean, do you think that that's a way that a chef can nourish their soul in the kitchen? You know, is that a way forward for a better a working environment, a better sort of psychic framework for a chef?
I mean, I very much enjoy it, and I take a lot of enjoyment and pleasure in doing that. And I don't think anybody wants to create waste. I don't think anyone feels good about wasting anything, especially people who put so much time, effort, love into a craft that they're often burning themselves out for. To throw something in the bin seems very ineffective to what you're trying to create. And if there's easier ways to create flavor and to do maybe less work and get better results, it's the work smart, not hard scenario. And if you can create flavor that guests love and that they will come back for, but it takes a quarter of the time, just you have to spend that time in advance. I think it's a no-brainer. And the pleasure of having things living in your kitchen and not being a dead environment where you can have microbes that are doing the work for you overnight, doing the work of millions of cooks just working away. Every time you leave the kitchen, the microbes are still working and they're developing flavor in those ingredients. It's a real joy.
That is such an awesome way to think about it. I love it. Okay, so let's talk about what's happening on the 19th of May in Melbourne from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Oxford Scholar. It is the Chef's Manifesto Action Hub, upskilling industry champions for circular hospitality. What does that all mean? What's happening?
It's going to be an amazing first Action Hub day. The Chef's Manifesto, there is currently no active community in Melbourne. And, you know, there's so many great things happening in Melbourne and Victoria. It makes so much sense to congregate chefs who are food system focused and bring them together to start something, you know, start a community, start some conversations. It is the initial meetup, so there'll be a lot of introductions, a lot of background on the Chef's Manifesto, what it is, why it's important, how it's benefited different chef communities around the world. And the focus is on building a zero waste future. So there'll be a lot of talk about food waste, a lot of insights in how we can negate food waste or even benefit from food waste. There'll be a really good community of chefs that are coming together that are all kind of like focused in the area. And the hope is that we'll build ambassadors from this one meetup, and then we can continue, have another Action Hub day in a few months. We can run demonstrations. The Moving Feast Kitchen can be a place where people can innovate and develop and share ideas. There'll also be a focus on beans, a call to action as part of the Beans is How campaign, which is another Chef's Manifesto affiliated campaign to double global bean consumption by 2028. They've actually ran, this is a little bit of a segue, but there was a beans on the menu competition run in London and New York for restaurants to put beans on the menu and showcase them as these are delicious. We should be eating more of them. They're cheap, packed with protein. They're great for farmers, great for the environment. They have a somewhat infinite shelf life if they're dried. So that'll be like another one of the focuses for the day.
Wow, that all sounds so cool. I would, if anyone needs a beans ambassador, I would love to be one. Beans are great. That sounds so cool. So can anybody just turn up? Should they register? How should they find out more?
We're currently putting together an invite list. It might be a fairly small affair with it being the first one. But there's still a few details to work out, and I guess we will release tickets or release ways of expressing interest in due course.
All right. Well, we'll put anything that we can in the show notes, and if anyone wants to message me, I'll connect you to the event or to Chris or to find out more. Chris, thank you so much for coming on for a chat today. It's always so inspiring to just be encouraged to think differently, and you know, the more radical, the better, I reckon. So thanks for starting these important conversations and getting people to think about flavor, not waste.
Yeah, thank you, Danny. I really appreciate it. And the Moving Feast Kitchen is open on market days and it's open to the public. You can walk in, anyone can come down and visit and pop their head in and see what we're up to.
Love it. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
This is Dirty Linen and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.